I'm joined today by Senator Deadman, Dyson, Bundy, and myself, Senator Green. We have two or three things on the agenda today. We're going to be changing order of the schedule a little bit and start with the capital project information from both Commerce, Community and Economic Development, and then Department of Corrections. And then those people left in the room can join us, continue to join us on the discussion on Senate Bill 141 and the walkthrough of the legislation that continues from yesterday's meeting. Okay, and we've also been joined by Olson and Hoffman, and who's here for Commerce? Morning.
Good morning. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Joellen Hanrahan. I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. Would you like to proceed this morning just to go
through your budget request for capital projects?
Okay, within the bill itself, the first project is the Manufacturing Extension Program. That has been moved to the supplemental. It's in an amendment. We will have that moved to the supplemental.
Okay.
So if we want to just...
So 40242 has been moved to the supplemental? Is that what you're saying?
40242, yes.
Okay. To the supplemental. Okay, thank you.
The next program is the Alaska Visitor Statistics Program. This is a long-term program. It's a comprehensive collection and presentation of information on Alaska's visitors. It provides demographics, characteristics of, and expenditure patterns and opinions of the people traveling to Alaska. It is used to look at the impact of visitor infrastructure and facilities, to determine investments in the visitor attractions and services, to look at the effect on state lands and other natural resources, and in developing tourism marketing program. This request is for $750,000 of general fund.
Are there any questions? Okay, go ahead.
Our next project is the tourism project.
Senator Bundy.
I do have a question.
Go ahead.
Obviously, this is a great asset to commercial enterprises in the visitor industry. And in many cases, we're looking at user pay. Can you, is there any way to estimate what the return to the general fund is for this expenditure of $750,000?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, I would have to go back and look at that question. There may be data already that addresses that through the increase in the number of visitors to the state and in the venues that we have promoted as a result of the travel data. And I can get back to you with some specific information on that if you would like.
Madam Chair, I just think it's something that we should look for more and more. Priming the pump is wise, but there should eventually get some water out of that pump for the state.
Thank you for your comments. Go ahead.
This project is a tourism project, reference number 40495, for $530,000. This is a project to promote and increase tourism in Alaska. It has five different sets to it. One is to increase the or augment the national cable television marketing by increasing the number of weeks that we advertise on national cable networks, such as the Travel Channel, Discovery Channel, Outdoor Life, A&E, and CNBC. The second part of that would be to expand the list of the national cable networks we advertise on. The secondary would be to increase our online advertising and our display ads on key trip planning websites, include some streaming video and other electronic ad formats. There's a large increase in number of consumers that are using the internet to research vacation locations and to book travel. And so we are trying to increase our presence in that area. We'd also like to enhance the Alaska, travelalaska.com website to include an online visitor forum and to enhance the activities section of the website. And I would just say from personal experience here on an online forum is that I last year planned an entire wedding using online forums. I personally know that it's extremely useful to have an online forum when you're trying to travel to a destination. The next area is
Madam Chairman.
Senator Bundy.
I just repeat my previous concern. Is creating jobs isn't enough. What does it return to the state? So.
Welcome, Senator Wilkin.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
On this appropriation, I see that it's for 1 year, and I was wondering, why are we doing this marketing? Is there a lull in the tourism industry in Alaska, or what's the justification for it if we're not going to be continuing the program in the future?
Well, this request is considered just a special multi-year project that these funds would be spent over probably more than 1 year and to give a boost to the tourism.
And then how much is going to be spent in 06 then?
I do not have that exact information with me. I didn't find that out.
Thank you.
Joel, maybe we could ask you to kind of, and I know we could find it if we go back through the budget and look, if we could find a kind of a layout of what all the different fund sources are for in the operating budget as well as the capital budget concerning this particular category, tourism, marketing, and the whole thing, and the ATIA, that whole segment, so that we can kind of consider
put
this in
together.
The whole.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
I can do that. Yes.
Would that help, Senator Hoffman, as well?
Yes.
And Senator Bundy? Thank you.
The fourth area for this tourism is to increase the highway independent travel by bringing pre-qualified journalists to experience the Alaska highways and relate this experience to their readers and viewers. The independent travelers on the Alaska highway is an area that has been experiencing limited growth, and we would like to see that get an extra boost. The fifth area is a Taiwan sales missions and training workshops. With the reestablished relationship between Alaska and Taiwan, the Asian tour operators have expressed an interest in developing a year-round tour product for Alaska. This funding would go towards a sales mission to Taipei with Alaska travel industry and its members to solidify the relationships and promote and tour the tour program.
Questions? Thank you. Go ahead.
Our next project is organization grants, reference number 40056 for $700,000. This is grants to that are provided for interim government operations and to defray the cost of transitioning from a city to a borough. These are entitlements under the Alaska Statute 29 that in the formation of a borough or an incorporated city that they receive a certain amount of funds. We are anticipating the potential for the Prince William Sound Borough to be forming, the city of Delta Junction, Delta Greeley area, possibly to be forming borough, Anchor Point in Nacogdoches.
This is just anticipation. This
well,
is not.
The Nacogdoches petition has already been filed, and Anchor Point has been making a lot of inquiries and has requested the forms. We anticipate that they may take a longer. The Prince William Sound Borough formation, there's been lots of discussion on where that is, and there's some anticipation that that will be happening within the next month or two, the filing. And Delta Greeley is on hold right now. But we're anticipating action in these areas, and we need to be able to respond within that first year. And I would note that this request is only for the first year money. Under Title 29, these communities are entitled to money for 3 years. So this is for the first year. It would allow us to respond for the first year.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. What's the total amount of money that the state gives the area for organization of a borough?
For borough or unified municipality, they get $300,000 for the first year, $200,000 for the second year, and $100,000 for the third year.
So over the period of time to get a borough set up, you get roughly $600,000? That amount was significantly higher than that. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
And that is the amount lined out in statute. Is that correct?
Yes, I believe that is in statute.
Any other questions, Senator Olson?
No, thank you, Madam Chairman.
Next item on our list is community development grants for $14,538,000, reference number 38943. This is an ongoing program for many years in the state. It funds multiple federal programs that enables commerce to provide grants to communities and nonprofit organizations for community development. Under this program is the Alaska's Floodplain and Erosion Management Program, which provides communities that participate in the National Flood Insurance Program with technical assistance and grants for the initial planning and subsequent construction of flood mitigation projects. Second are mini grants, which are grants to rural communities for projects that develop, expand, or diversify a community's economy. This is estimated at $800,000. I believe that's $800,000. I don't have my glasses with me here. The third area is the multi-use facilities. These are grants to communities for the construction or remodeling of multi-use facilities in rural Alaska. Communities contribute 10 to 25% of the cost of these projects. The fourth area is accelerated infrastructure development grants. This is the development of community profile maps for unmapped communities. Beginning in FY05 and continuing through FY06, another 48 communities in the lower Kuskokwim, Bering Straits, Copper Valley, and Southeast will be mapped. Fifth area is Delta Junction missile defense impact. These funds are to mitigate the impact of the construction and operation of the missile defense test bed facilities at Fort Greely. These funds are provided by the Department of Defense. And last is the Bulk Fuel Bridge Program. This is for $38,000 to cover the administrative costs of our Bulk Fuel Bridge Loan Program.
Questions? Next item.
The next item is community block grants for $6,115,000, reference number 38946. This is also a long-term program in the department. This is provided for grants to communities and nonprofits that provide services and or benefit the low to moderate income individuals. This is also a federally funded program with some general match, a very small amount of general match, general fund match. This provides for the community services block grants that go to the Rural CAP, the Rural Alaska Community Action Program, and it helps to fund educational programs for prevention of alcohol and drug abuse, prevention of fetal alcohol syndrome, child development programs, and other training programs. The second area that's funded under community block grants is the food and nutrition grants. This is a very small amount of money, about $15,000. This helps fund nonprofits to work and provide services to the homeless throughout Alaska. The community development grants is our third item funded under this. This program provides grants not to exceed $200,000 to municipalities for planning, infrastructure, and economic development activities, which are for low to moderate income individuals. The fourth area is emergency shelter grants. This is an area that's authorized under federal public law, and it provides grants to nonprofit corporations to provide services and facilities to the abused and homeless.
Any questions? Go ahead.
Our next project is the energy projects for $23,220,000. this project, and I would like to, we're dealing with the original version and not any amendments at this time, is that correct?
That's just my understanding.
Okay, so my dollar amount would be different there.
I have $20 million here.
The original project was $20,750,000.
Right.
Dollars. This is also funds multiple federal energy programs, bulk fuel upgrades, rural power system upgrades, alternative energy, and energy efficiency projects.
Are there any questions? Does anyone need further information on that rather long, large request?
We'll note that it is, Madam Chair, it is mostly federally funded.
It is mostly federally funded.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Our next item is electrical emergencies.
Well, I'm not looking forward to the day that they might want to replace that with GF.
That's true. That is true. Are we on 32590?
32590, correct. For $330,000 for electrical emergencies. These funds provide technical support when an electrical utility has lost the ability to generate or transmit power to its customers, and there's a threat to life, health, and property in the community. Excuse me.
Golden Valley fly to here.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Golden Valley apply it when you've lost your ability.
Okay, next one.
Okay, next item is the NPRA National Program Receipts Impact Grant Program. The original amount on this was for $29,517,700. This program provides grants to communities for public facilities and services for those communities that are directly or severely impacted by the leases and development of oil and gas within the National Petroleum Reserve.
Where might the listing of those projects be? Have you included the list of those projects in this?
We've not included the list in this, but we can get that list to you.
That would be good. Thank you. Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've been doing some work on this in our office, and I wonder if you would consider assigning this 38948 to a subcommittee chaired by myself and any others from the committee you may want to put on it. And we'll develop this a little more thoroughly and bring it back to the committee for their consideration.
Like to do that, Senator Wilkin.
Thank you.
Get that, Senator Shedman.
I'm sure I volunteer to assist Senator Wilkin in this endeavor.
Okay, Senator Olson.
Yes.
Senator Dyson. Sounds like we're going to have a committee of the whole here pretty soon. Okay, Senator Wilkin, we'll name you as subcommittee. Report back to the committee, and you'll have as your members Stedman, Olson, and Dyson. If there's anyone else you want to have named to that, let me know, and we'll.
Okay, thank you.
And if you will start getting together the information that you could probably anticipate that's going to be wanted, and then certainly Senator Wilkin can contact you with any other information.
Okay, thank you. Will do.
Thank you, Joellen. Go ahead.
The next project is our Kodiak launch site infrastructure for $36 million, reference number 40008. This is a fully federally funded request. It has to do with bringing the Kodiak launch site, meeting the requirements of the Department of Defense for the Kodiak launch site. They have certain requirements of this facility. Every so many years needs to be inspected and has to be up to par on. It's anticipated that they will be receiving this money to try and meet those requirements.
Thank you.
The next item on the list is the Protection and Education Assistance for $300,000, reference number 40505. And at this time, Madam Chair, I would like to say that we will be withdrawing or amending this project. It will no longer be requested. This money is now, we've discovered that this money cannot come directly to the state. The state can make recommendations for it to go to entities within our state. The next project is the Morris Thompson Cultural and Visitor Center for $250,000, reference number 40500. This is for the cultural.
Hold on just a minute, Something's out of order.
Madam Chair, before
yes.
we move on, I'm wondering on 40505, with other legislation that's before this committee that would encourage people to be involved in a defined contribution retirement program, if monies like these could be directed to PERS and TERS so that they could have an informed group of investors.
Good suggestion. Thank you. Okay. And you're on 40500. Is that correct? That's your next item?
40500. It's the Morris Thompson Cultural Visitor Center. This center is located in Fairbanks. It will provide visitor information, services, trip planning, environmental education, and exhibits. The total anticipated cost of the project is $26 million. There's $15 million of federal funds, and the remaining funds will come from state and private contributors, and they're requesting $250,000 from the state to go towards this project for FY06.
What is the anticipated to completion on this project, do you know?
I think I may have that information here. Anticipated completion. It currently is just completing the conceptual design and facility phase. No formal bids have yet been requested. They're planning that the construction bids will be completed by spring of 2006. And to achieve that, they need to raise $4.5 million this year. So the long-term estimated completion date, I don't know, but construction bids are estimated for spring of 2006.
Is this the only amount we'll find in the budget for the Morris Thompson Cultural Center in the entire budget? $250,000?
Madam Chair, this is the only amount that I know of that's in there for our department, but I can look further for that.
Okay, we may come back to that. Thank you. Next one.
Madam Chair, I see that I've skipped in order here. That's a little bit different than was in the bill, and I want to make sure that I'm in line with where you are and where the next project you would like.
And where would you be next?
Next is the City of Valdez
Harborview. Okay.
City of Valdez Harborview demolition is a request for $1 million with a reference number 40517. This is to demolish the old Harborview Developmental Center that was closed in 1997. The land on which this building sits was transferred to the City of Valdez The building remains, the city and the state have looked at this to see if they could find any alternative uses. They have not found any that are, would be economical uses. The city is requesting funds to demolish the building and to address the remediation issues that will be needed because of some hazardous materials found within the building.
Do you know if the city then carries the liability for any hazardous material found?
If they would be carrying the liability during the demolition?
And after? Or is the state's just to provide the money and the state's out of the risk and the discussion?
Madam Chair, that's a very good question.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. Senator Wilken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wonder, Joellen, if we could get the funding history of this. I don't know how many times we can tear this building down. So if we could just find out. This is my seventh year on finance, and this is my seventh request for tearing down Harborview. So I thought we had done this two or three times. But if we could just get the past history.
Welcome through the chair. I'll do that.
Thank you. That would be good. Thank you.
Next item. The next item that I have on my list is the Tagus Coast Aquarium. I'm very welcome to flip to this in here. That's fine.
Page 30.
Tagus Coast Aquarium is $100,000 for 40497. This number. This is a regional facility that will provide education, research, and exhibits focusing on the coastal and marine ecosystems of Southeast Alaska. It's a grant for the assistance in constructing 28,000 square foot aquarium.
Mm-hmm. Again, along with the Morris Thompson Cultural Business Center, I'd like to know what the total cost is for this, the Tagus Coast Aquarium, what the state is being asked to provide, what the federal government has provided in the past, and where they intend to get the rest of the money. If we could just kind of get the funding history for both those projects, past, current, and future.
That's beneficial.
Okay. Thank you.
I can give you a short status on that project right now. That project is under the design phase. Mm-hmm. The design phase is almost complete, actually. No formal bids have been requested. The estimated total cost at this time is $27 million. Mm-hmm. They are anticipating that they would like state funding between $1 million and $4 million ultimately.
Okay, not for this year.
Not for this year. This year we're just going with $100,000.
Rebounding with good ideas. Go ahead. Next item.
The next project that I have here is the Alaska Native Heritage Center for $500,000, reference number 40498. This money is for the repair and construction of Alaska Native Village exhibit sites. This is the only statewide Native educational and cultural center in Alaska that showcases the cultures of Alaska Native people to the public and to our school children. It's a premier tourist destination, and it's in partnership with the International Alaska Tour Operators. There's over 100,000 visitors to the city of Anchorage that come to this facility. It also provides 100-plus jobs and is a marketing outlet for the rural handicrafts and cultural art items.
And projects of this sort can't function on their income and their resources and their other various private donors and gifts?
This project, what this funding is asking for at this point is to contribute towards the proposed construction of one village site and a playground for the children within that site. This, the phases on this project will be ultimately developing five village sites to represent the dwellings for each of the five state regions.
Okay, but this implies, the description is for the repair and construction of exhibit sites.
Correct.
And I would just assume that repairs would be wrapped up in their cost of ticketing and other things that they, they're income producing. I just wanted to be sure that they, it had been set up to self-start and self-sustain, where this will not be an ongoing state request outside the, in this forum, at least. Any other questions?
Madam Chair, I'll check on that and get back to you.
Thank you, appreciate it. Thank you.
The next project I have is the Lower Kuskokwim School District, the People's Learning Center, for $1 million, reference number 40502. This is another grant to a named recipient. This is for the construction of the People's Learning Center. The total cost of this project is approximately $8 million. Sorry, the consortium has raised $13 million, and they have requested some additional funds from the Alaska Native Education Grant Program, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and from Senator Stevens' office, and they're requesting this $1 million through the state.
Okay, Senator Hoffman, you have to pronounce the name again.
It's Narvit.
Narvit. Okay, thank you. It's the Narvit. Okay. Any questions?
The next project up is the City of Unalaska Boat Harbor for $2 million, reference number 40501.
Page 27, if you need to go back in your packet.
I do apologize, my packet's not together in the same order as your packet. These funds are for a grant to the City of Unalaska for a small boat harbor at Little South America, Unalaska, to address a serious lack of moorage. The total project is, the breakwater project is expected to cost $11 million, and the City of Unalaska is responsible for the inner harbor improvements and are expected to cost $17 million, and they are requesting $2 million from us for this portion of the project in constructing a small boat harbor.
Senator Stedman?
Madam Chairman, could I get a little bit more of an explanation on apparently the match? So this would be the total cost to the state, $2 million, to help the city come up with the funds to put in their floats, is that correct, and finish the harbor?
Senator Stedman, through the chair, our funds would be, the state funds would be paying directly for the small boat harbor.
Senator Stedman, what information do you need?
I was just kind of curious if this was going to be the maximum impact to the state or not. It's just a $2 million request to assist the city in coming up with their match for the floats, or is this going to be an ongoing request to help them build up to the $17 million expected cost in the inner harbor?
If we could get that information back, please.
Could I do one more follow-up?
Senator Stedman.
I'd also like to get some follow-up information on, after the construction, the income factors being used by the city. In other words, the mortgage rates being charged, and I'm looking for some assurance that there will be enough mortgage collected to do the ongoing maintenance and replacement reserves. So this harbor in 30 years doesn't end up like numerous other harbors throughout the state in a dilapidated condition.
Senator Bundy.
Just along those lines, referring back to the Learning Center, can I get some information on how they're operating, the maintenance costs are going to be covered?
Did you have your hand up, Senator Olson?
Actually, I didn't, Madam Chairman. Is this, just remind me if you're familiar with it, isn't this the site that was the staging area for the shipwreck of the Sullendine Ayu down there on Unalaska Island? It is not?
Senator Olson, through the chair, I'm not familiar with that. I do not know the answer to that, but that is an excellent question.
For some reason, I thought it was.
We can get back to you on that, Senator Olson.
Are there any other questions? Is that your last item, or do we have one more?
We have the City of Cordova, Cordova Center, for $1 million. This is for the construction of a community center in Cordova, using both bond funds and general funds. It's for the construction of 32,000 square foot community center to provide conference, convention, theater, and training spaces, oil spill response training, incident and emergency command and communications center, and to use as a joint federal and state visitors facility, possibly a public library for the elementary school.
And Madam Chair, the same question about where they get their O&M money.
Operation and maintenance, where does it come from? Do you have further items, or is that the last one?
That's the last project.
Thank you. Are there any questions or any other information anyone would need for Ms. Hanrahan to bring to the committee? We'll take it. Senator Wilkins.
Is there not a film project?
The film project is not here. It's our understanding that the Rasmussen Fund is...
Oh, okay.
That is not being funded.
Okay. Good.
We're going to take about a two-minute break. And next up is the Department of Corrections, who will give us their capital budget request review. Welcome, Commissioner and Sharp.
Good morning, Madam Chairman. My name is Mark Antrim with the Alaska Department of Corrections. We have four items for the committee to consider this morning. The first is an item amount of $2.5 million, reference number 40267. This is for digital video recording equipment and closed-circuit television systems throughout our correctional facilities. Essentially, this is kind of a two-part project. The first part will be to install cameras, and the second part will be to install the recording equipment. Classically, what we've always done is put cameras in movement areas and around doors. We've never installed them in living areas, so as a result, we have quite a few problems in our institutions throughout dormitories and areas where prisoners work. We haven't had cameras installed in the past. We have two facilities that have what we consider to be model systems installed right now. What we've found is that the installation of camera systems reduce incidents of prisoner violence dramatically, as well as property damage in these areas. So we're going to expand these kinds of systems to all of our correctional facilities. This will also put us in complete compliance with the Prison Rape Elimination Act of 2003, a federal law which mandates zero tolerance in lockup facilities of all kinds to prevent the incidence of prison rape. So.
Any questions? Next item.
The second item is an $8 million request, reference number 36788. This involves extensive deferred maintenance for our facilities. The department maintains 117 buildings across the state, the majority of which are in excess of 20 years of age, roughly 10% in excess of 30 years of age, and the remaining 10% also in excess of 4 years of age. So we've got some old buildings. We have an extensive list as part of your package as to what's involved here. I'm not sure you want to run through each and every project, but suffice it to say there's major structural issues involving things like roofs, windows, and doors at each of our major facilities statewide.
Does anyone have any questions about any of the requested projects or line items on that for the maintenance? Okay, thanks, Mark. Go ahead.
Yeah. The Madam Chairman, the third item is in amount of $450,000, reference number 30815. This involves equipment replacement along the same lines of our deferred maintenance in our buildings. We have a lot of equipment around the state. We operate a fleet of 16 points that's currently valued at $16.7 million in equipment. And basically, this is items like snow removal equipment, grounds maintenance equipment, lawnmowers, what have you, as well as fixed items in our kitchens, stoves, steam kettles, those kinds of things, microwave ovens. We have been deferring maintenance for many, many years, and so this request covers the replacement for many of those critical items.
Go ahead.
The last item is a request for $100,000. This is reference number 30818. This is to establish a series of project funds to support our community jail component. We have currently 14 contracts with local communities around the state to provide, to operate what are known as community jails. These facilities are run by local police departments. We hope to have 15 here if the city of Kotzebue is willing to sign this year. But at any rate, what this money will do is support similar projects like those we're engaging in our correctional facilities for these community jails and provide that very much needed support for many of these facilities, which are also aging.
Are there any questions on any of these requests? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman.
That completes the two capital department reviews for capital projects. Ms. Eady, we'll continue those tomorrow's meeting, but now we will go on to the walkthrough of Senate Bill 141. And those of you who have weren't here yesterday to see the presentation, we've gotten kind of good reviews back, and I think Senator Stedman's going to be getting some kind of Oscar award for his presentation on his presentation quality and information is good and well done. So, Senator Stedman, if you would to go ahead and continue with the walkthrough information to present.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Today, rather than do a slideshow, everybody has a little packet here of some slides, and we're just going to kind of flip through them.
Senator Stedman?
Yes.
Just for a moment. Senator Wilken?
Senator Chair, yesterday you asked us to hold our questions, and I had a couple. So
okay,
should we do those now or after?
It's up. For you, Senator Stedman?
We can do it right now.
Now's fine. Go ahead.
I had a question on two questions. Page 10 of the presentation yesterday, the chart that looks like this.
Hey, just a second here. I got to dig my presentation out here.
The upward graph. The upward moving graph.
Yeah, there. And so,
page 10.
Uh-huh. Yes. Down in the notes, it says actuarial value of assets. And in that description, the last sentence says, prior to 2002, Mercer used a corridor method. Beginning in 2002, they switched to a five-year smoothing. What does that mean in relation to that graph? It must have a bearing because it's on the chart. So could you put it in, dumb it down to me to tell me what that means?
If we we're on page 10 for the folks that don't want to follow along. What we're talking about here is the green line is the market value of the assets of the portfolio. And at the very beginning of the chart, they used a smoothing method for calculating gains and losses in the portfolio. And what that smoothing method does, the idea there is they take any gains or losses and they amortize them out over 5 years or spread them out over 5 years. Because the concept is to try to smooth out the employer contribution rate. So the employer contribution rate doesn't swing with the gyrations of the financial markets. So when there's really good times, contribution rates go down or vice versa. Well, there was an extended run in the capital markets in the late 90s positively, which pushed the value of the portfolio up above the targeted growth rates quite a bit. And you can see just the growth of the green line going up. So if they would have used those values that from a smoothing method, it would have showed a substantially larger substantially larger overfunding of the plan assets to liabilities, where there was some concern that there would have been an interest to lower the contribution rate to unsustainable levels. In other words, lower the amount that the employer contributes to near zero, or even possibly zero. So what the actuary did is they changed the method of calculating the gains, and they used what they called the corridor method, and they put a band around it, and it had to stay within, I think it was 20% up and down of the market value. So they put a band, so that artificially lowered the assets for the calculation of how far they were overfunded, and that is the little black line with the black squares. That's called the actuarial value of assets. So they use that calculating method for a period of several years in the peak of the equity expansion or bull market of the late 90s. Well, when the auditor came in and did a bunch of work, which is where we had the dispersion there at the end, showing the red line and the green lines substantially deviating away from each other. One of the things they recommended, or one of the items of correction, was to go back to the smoothing and they use a five-year amortization schedule now like they used before. In other words, they take the gain or the loss and then they spread that out over the upcoming 5 years, and then every year they go forward a year and they take whatever gain and loss that year is and they go forward. And again, it's to smooth out the contributions of the employer. What that did was they needed to bring the assets to market value, and that's why in year 2002 the valuation or the green line equals the little black line where the two lines come together. They're just two ways of calculating the assets. Now, if we go forward 1 year to 2003, the market value is again the green line, and it shows it at 10.9, and these are in billions for those following us at home, 10.9 billion in assets, where the actuarial value showing it at 11.4 billion. That the difference between those two numbers is just the 5% smoothing or 5% amortization of that loss going forward. So now this year, when we see the new numbers, they had a performance in their portfolio above their 8.25% target, so that's going to be a gain. They'll take that gain that they made above 8.25% and they'll spread it out over 5 years. So what we want to do as policymakers is always look at both values, recognizing that actuarial value is really just a value to smooth the contributions, and we need to pay particular attention to is market values. What's the portfolio actually worth? So it was, if we can go down a couple of pages to page 14 on the right-hand side of page 14, there's a green bar showing 15.52% or 15.5%. What that represents is when they changed from the smoothing to the corridor method, and then back from the corridor to the smoothing, when they changed that movement back, it put downward pressure on the contribution rate of the employer. That amounted to 15.5% of the total changes of that contribution rate change, which was 18, from 1998 to 2003. So that was a positive. It lowered the contribution requirement down. So that's why that bar is green and the effect. So that's how it ties into why it was used and how it ties into the employer contribution rate.
So if I could, so the question is what went wrong? So what I think I just heard, correct me, Senator Stem, if I'm incorrect. Because if I take my ruler and just draw a simple trend line, you know, today equals, it's almost a straight trend line from 94 to today.
Correct.
If we would have stayed with the smoothing method. So is it that simple to say, had we stayed with the smoothing method and resisted the temptation to lower rates because of a robust capital market, that today we wouldn't have the $5 billion shortfall? Or we wouldn't have a major portion of it? Is it that simple?
Go ahead and repeat that one more time.
Had we not made the decision in 1995 to switch from the smoothing method, which I think this must be a five-year rolling average, or a five-year rolling average, if we had not made that decision to go from an average method, a smoothing method, to the corridor method, and had the ability to resist the temptation to lower rates in good capital markets, would our red line not have tracked, excuse me, the black line not have tracked what we show there as the green line?
Pretty close. I think what would have most likely ended up happening, though, is that if they didn't switch to that corridor method in the middle, the boards would have been under more pressure to lower the contribution rate, because I don't believe that they realize that their value of the assets were so undervalued, mm-hmm. that the liabilities that they were looking at were not the actual liabilities. There were some liability, in my opinion, that was miscalculated, which led to a false impression that they were, you know, at a artificially low level. So I think if the liabilities would have been more accurately calculated back in the mid to late 90s, it would have tracked almost on top of the market value of the portfolio, and then there would have certainly been no pressure to lower rates. Does that?
Yeah, that does help. Yeah, thank you. And I had one other question. I'm just wondering, as we've kind of walked through this, we depend a lot on our actuarial. I'm just wondering, I don't know if you have it with you, but I'd be interested to know what we pay our actuarial every year and what we pay them since whatever time we've contracted with this particular one or others for that matter. You don't have to do that now unless you have it.
We got some rough numbers. Apparently the person involved in a lot of this is on vacation. It's roughly about $4 million since 1997 through 2005. So, you know, it's the high year is 2000, for which was about $717,000. And that was a year when there was the audit going on. Some more work. The audit was a little later. The targeted rate's about $500 a year. And in 2004, they went a little bit above that. 2005, they're looking at $425,000. So it's a complex mathematical modeling work that's done, and it's very expensive, and it's unfortunate, I guess, that it wasn't as accurate as I would like to have seen it in the late 90s.
Okay, thank you, Senator Sennett. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Bundy.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I delve in here cautiously, knowing that this is a complicated field. But I do get nervous if we don't like the answer, we just change it to a different calculation until we get an answer we like. But to plumb your research here, if I could. In my memory of my service here, I remember being told by the experts, whoever they are, that the fund was basically overcapitalized, that we were contributing too much, and at some point the legislature made a decision based on the advice of the experts to reduce our contribution. Now, you'd mentioned they've attempted to reduce the pressure for further reductions, but there was a, in the last 10 years, there was a reduction of state contribution, was there not, based on information that we were overcapitalized?
My understanding is that there has been, in the past, some withdrawals. We didn't, offhand, I'd have to go back and dig those out.
If my memory says about 94, 95.
Yeah, it could be. I know that it did take place. We concentrated more the last several years when we're trying to work through this equation. But that is, in fact, true. If you have an overfunded plan and you take assets out, when the day comes when you're underfunded, you've exaggerated the problem.
And Madam Chair, I just wanted to bring this point up because I'm hearing occasionally from people who say, you know, the state screwed up. Why should we have to increase our contribution? Well, I don't know that the legislature, and at some place in the press it was said, well, the legislature reduced their contributions in an attempt to artificially show they were cutting the budget. And you know, and I really reject that because it was on based on advice from the PERS and TERS board that they got from their actuarials that the legislature reduced contributions that had nothing to do with some artificial budget caps. This was advice from PERS and TERS.
The board, both TERS and PERS, for different degrees, have in the late 90s lowered their employer contribution rate below what the actuary recommended. And that also, you know, puts more negative pressure in the system. We attempt to rectify that in our in Senate Bill 141.
Thank you.
And I think some of that changing and lowering of rates was done without legislative permission.
The latest, yeah, I believe the latest change was.
And we've gone through and calculated that difference, what it would have meant to the plan if those didn't take place. And memory served me right, it's 160, 190 million. Sounds like a lot of money, which it is, but when we're dealing with $5 billion, $5 billion's a big, big hole. I don't know how else to put it. It's just a big hole.
Any other questions before we go on? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm looking at page 8. We go back and look at the average. It seems as though in 03 we're funding the we're at about a 70% level of funding. But you go back to 1980, we're about at that same rate. And given the fact that, you know, we hear the economists and we hear President Bush saying that the economy is turning around, the markets are rebounding, and in light of the fact that on the previous page we had heard testimony that that next year we're going to see a positive, without any changes, there's going to be a positive flow. So I anticipate that percentage is probably going to be at its lowest level. And I was wondering a couple of questions. Number one, was there any major changes back in the late 70s, early 80s, besides the what we've heard of changing of the contribution rates to rebound this, or was that simply just the growth of state government? And number two, I guess, given the fact that we're probably, you know, do you anticipate that we're at the bottom of the barrel, or what we had heard previously, that this we will be seeing a rebound in the percentage of our market value? I'm not saying that, you know, we should not be making the management changes, but the system has worked well. And the final comment, I guess, is on page 7. the graphic there is it seems to be inverted. The uncolored amount should be the amount that we're full, and the You know, we're two-thirds full and one-third empty. It shows that we're one-third empty, two-thirds empty and one-third full from the graphic, so it makes it look like, hey, we have a big, big problem here. But from this graph here, it's really over-exaggerated, from my view.
Let me, because there's a multitude of questions. On page 8, you know, the issue of, you know, can we expect a replication of 1975 or, you know, in the late 70s to the early 80s, can we expect that type of a replication in our funding ratio? In other words, our funding ratio going closer and closer to fully funded fairly quick over 10 years. And in my opinion, it would be extremely difficult to do that just because of the magnitude of what we're dealing with today versus what we dealt with then, just the amount of employees and the amount of retirees. And we've got some escalating issues with healthcare costs that we didn't have in the late 70s. From 82 through 90, we had a real strong capital market, which helped push the values up. And then in the early, or in that same time frame, in the late 70s, early 80s, we had a huge expansion statewide. So I don't think that that's going to get replicated. But going forward, well, let me stop and go into your other question and then tie that other answer in. If we look at our funding ratios, I don't know what the funding ratios are going to be when they give us the numbers this week. I haven't seen those, and they're keeping them secret till they deliver them to us. I expect the funding ratios to go down, even though last year the portfolio did very well, above the 8.25. They amortize those gains out for 5 years, do some smoothing. So I think that the real effect is we're probably not in any real, we're in a little bit better shape than we were a year ago. Even though I expect these funding ratios to show us a little worse shape, it's just the way the math works. So, you know, from this point going forward, you know, I would expect us not to see another, and I hope that we don't see another decline in the financial markets for 2 or 3 years, and I think the odds are against that. So the portfolio should help bring us to fully funded, but I don't think it's going to be anywhere near as fast as it could in the late 70s and early 80s. But definitely it's going to put upward pressure on those funding ratios. The issue of the barrel being half empty, quarter empty, I suppose, you know, in retrospect, we could have done that. We could have taken that 16 and showed it, you know, two-thirds full, because it is two-thirds full, roughly. We could go ahead and correct that on the presentation going forward. That's not a problem. We put, this is on page 7, that's why we put the total liabilities of 16.4 and then the net assets at 11.4, so people can see what the what is full and what is empty. There is, and I would have to agree with Senator Hoffman, kind of alluding to the point anyway, that even though we have a $5 billion underfunding issue in front of us, it's not anywhere near the point where we have a cash flow problem meeting our obligations, or there's no reason for any of the retirees or current participants to expect that their benefit levels are in jeopardy. That's not the issue. What ends up happening, the impact of that $5 billion, and hopefully after we go through Senate Bill 41 and we reconstitute the board and we get the restructuring, that restructured board, one of the tasks that we'll give them is to work on how to address this $5.5 billion. One of the solutions is just to ignore it. Another one is to, you know, pay it off, and the other one is some combination. And there's a multitude of things that can be done, but the overriding factor that squeezes us on that underfunding is the contributions that the employers have to make relative to the rest of their salary. So it squeezes the schools as far as directing more money into current cash flow into benefits along with municipalities in the state. It directs current cash flow today into benefits that were accumulated, some of them over a decade ago. So it's an issue that we need to work on to try to alleviate the cash flow to the state, the municipalities, and the schools. Does that
answers, you know, my points, but, you know, I think the point that we all should be considering is that this is a major change, and, you know, even if we're talking about changing the management structure, that would be a major change, and, you know, I think that there is room for a review and a change in the management structure, but for us to take all of that and do it all at once, you know, maybe a little bit more than we should be doing, but, you know, I'm still open to review of that, but I'm a little bit concerned about the magnitude of the change, this big giant step when, as you said, the fund is viable. It's a lot better than, you know, other states, and for us to change the management structure, and if that doesn't make changes, then pursue this other factor, because changing the whole process, I think, when you're looking at the financial security and trying to draw employees back into state service, as you said, is another major critical factor that we have to take into consideration.
Senator Bundy.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. One of the things I hear from people is, oh my gosh, you're trying to sneak this through too quickly. And at least from where I sit, the discussion of whether Alaska ought to change to a defined contribution program over the defined benefit has been going on at least 10 years in these halls somewhere, and so it's not a sudden change. But I have a question for Senator Stedman that maybe I'm asking for information that's not available and part of it's speculation, but we've been talking about trend lines, and in 1975 there were approximately 2,000 worker bees who were supporting the retirement system, and there were just over 1,700 retirees. Now in 2004 we've got 43,300 worker bees that are supporting a retirement system, and there are about 28,000 active retirees. You know, that ratio is diminishing, and can we project a trend line that say one day there will be one worker for every retiree, or one, or perhaps put it the other way, one retiree for every worker? And, you know, that sounds somewhat like Social Security system and its problems.
Madam Chair, the answer to that is yes, and we've looked at that, and we've got forecasts that basically show the accumulation. Back in 1975 there were 1,700 in retirees, now there's 28,000, and there's another almost 20,000 that have some claim on the system. If they come back in and work for a few more years, they could retire. And that's one of the challenges when we look at can the late 70s and early 80s be replicated and the problem just goes away in 10 years as far as our funding. Our portfolio grows and brings us up to full funding. We have a substantial weighting difference today concerning our retirees and the cash flow demands it makes on the system. That's why, you know, I would have to agree with the conclusion drawn by the actuary that you're not going to invest your way out of this situation at all?
So that if everyone that has a potential claim on the retirement system realize that claim, we actually have one retiree for every worker making contributions to the system, and that doesn't sound like anything that's sustainable.
There's quite a few people around the state, and some people have left the state, that have had past service with the state of Alaska. Maybe they worked a year or 2 years or 3 years, and then went on and did something else. So they say they were, it was in the 70s or the 80s, they would be a tier one. So they could come back in, work for a couple of years, and then retire and get their lifetime health benefits. It's about $100 million in potential liability that the state faces. We looked into that. I guess theoretically, if all these other 20 additional thousand people came in, grabbed their benefit, and then opted out, you know, we'd have more retired people than we have active. I think eventually we're going to pretty much get there anyway over the next 20, 30 years as more people, you know, retire into the system. But that is why you pre-fund health care in your retirement system, and in particular the health care. So you don't end up with the situation that you're addressing, where you have one employee and then one retired, or some ratio thereabouts. So that's why I think the state of Alaska should be congratulated for foresight years ago setting up and pre-funding health care. Even though today we're having a little challenge with it, we're certainly better off than the vast majority of others.
Thank you.
Sir Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in 10 years, what's the ratio going to look like? Do you have any projection on that?
Madam Chair, I have to get back to the Senator's question. We have that. We actually have it broken down year by year, out probably 25 years at least.
And as I look at this chart on page 8, we look at the downward trend during the late 90s. But before that, we see an upward trend there. What was the price of oil was down so low back during those periods of times, and many of the businesses were going bankrupt? Why don't we see a more negative influence on the trend line?
Are they
independent of each other?
Well, I would say the two big impacts on these trend lines are the value put on the liabilities, and then the value of the assets in the portfolio. And those were fairly robust economic times, even though we had some fluctuating issues with oil prices. But the portfolio is the retirement portfolio is not geared that directly with oil, other than the impact oil has on the economy overall.
Sir Nelson?
The last comment I have is that I see $5.5 billion, a big, large amount of liability that's out there. And I commend the sponsor of the legislation that he is actively trying to get something done, and rather than wait to see what other issues can come out there, any delay I think is only going to exacerbate the liability, and so I'm in favor of it, certainly looking at an alternative way, because right now all I see is failure. If my personal portfolio had this type of a record or hedge roll, of course I don't have a portfolio.
But something to add to the conversation too is that when these sorts of things come along and you see the increased call for school districts, municipalities, each agency and the state government, everything, it is a natural inclination, obviously, for people to turn to the state to backfill and to make good on the shortage or the increase that's coming up. And if you project that increase out over the years, there's a point at which the state loses all incentive to continue to fund that shortfall, and then employment does drop off, because you can't continue to employ people if you're going to be paying an additional 50% plus of their salary just to pay for benefits. So we have, this is why it's become very important for us to get on with the solution and not let it wait another year. Are you ready to begin your presentation now on the overview?
Yes, Madam Chairman. Again, back to the handout for today, we're just going to start walking through the bill, and again, we expect, as with any major legislation, that there'll be a lot of input and there'll be some modifications, and some of them may be substantial before we get down to the final review to decide to go forward or not. But what we looked at, well, when we started this project, what we decided to do very early on was not come up with a financial component to fix the $5 billion issue at hand and right away. And the issue there is we felt it was more important to deal with the structural components of how we got here and why we're here. And then after that, after we deal with that, come back and deal with the underfunding issue, because you have to stem the hemorrhage. And that comes down to, and we've talked about how do we prevent this from happening again. And I think one of the issues is we're going to be working over the years with the actuaries and the boards to have them justify the value of their assets and their liabilities, be assured that we're looking at as good a numbers as possible. And then how do we fix the system and bring it back? Again, that comes down into the board restructure and having one entity responsible for both the assets and the liabilities, so we get away from the buck passing and we can get straight answers at this table. And then how do we better predict our control costs going forward? And that's one of the things we'll work on through the bill, as far as areas that we need to look at cost containments or tightening up things. The financial component, again, we need to look at, you know, the issue of the liability growth, and some of these things we've touched on a little bit yesterday and today. We need to stabilize the employer contribution rates, and in my opinion, we need to try to lower them because of the squeeze-out effect it has on today's cash flow to pay yesterday's benefits for the employees. It has a lot of negative impacts all across the state. And then how do we provide near-term financial relief to the employers? I think that issue is going to be after Senate Bill 141 is hopefully implemented and in place, that new board will address hopefully the $5 billion shortfall issue and come back with recommendations, and that'll be a whole other process. And that leads into the last one. But if when we look at the, we can just stop for a minute and kind of hit on another issue. The $5 billion shortfall, I just want to reemphasize, and it's going to be repeated numerous times, that obligation is an obligation under defined benefit plan of the employer. And it's not the employee's problem per se. They did not create this issue. The funding that the employee pays ongoing is what they call a normal cost factor, and that is they contribute today, and that is to, I'm simplifying this because there's a year delay, but they contribute today for the benefits accumulated today that'll take into the future. Well, right now we've got a bunch of accumulated benefits in the past that need to be paid for, but one of the which is an issue that hopefully the new board's going to address dealing with the $5 billion. But the issue of is the split of the current rate, which is split roughly two-thirds, roughly, well, for PERS, it's 66% that the employer pays and 34% for the
employee. Is that a reasonable split still today under today's economic conditions with raising and changing healthcare trends? In the bill, we put in there where that's going to, there's a trigger in there to get that reviewed. It's not anything set in stone. It's just an item concerning the benefit package that we need to explore and either accept the current standards or recommend some modifications. And there's some modification language in there currently. But I just want to get that on the table, that it's just an item of discussion and one of the multiple points to walk through. And I think we would not be doing a thorough review if we just ignored that particular issue. But if I can just shift gears a little bit, how we came up with this tier, the Finance Committee asked the Chairs and Purs boards to review tier structures a year ago, and there was a lot of work done or so, and there was a lot of work done on tier structures and different alternatives. There was employer surveys done. There were focus groups done, member focus groups. There's benchmarks. There was benefit levels reviewed. They looked at demographic projections, implications of Medicare changes, trends, cost analysis, projections. So what we did is we did not go back in and start from scratch. The boards, as everybody sitting here realizes, the boards did not adopt a recommendation to implement a new tier. One board tied and one failed. They reviewed two types of tiers. One was a combination, defined benefit and defined contribution, and the other one was a pure defined contribution. We chose, as a starting point, a pure defined contribution plan, as we had to pick one of the two tiers. So we picked one of them, which we thought was the best, and built that into Senate Bill 141. So,
Senator Stedman. Yes. Senator Bundy has a question.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. And in this tier committee review data, I'm hearing from a surprising number of people, and it's surprising to me, a number of people who are apparently work for the state, who are indicating it's becoming increasingly difficult to get people to work for the state, to hire talented people. They're indicating that we're going to have to settle for second best or something like that. And that does not mesh with what's been my experience in the past. And one of their concerns is if we change the retirement, it's going to reduce the ability to recruit talented people to work for the state. Did you review this information? Does that appear to be a factor, and how big a factor is it?
We did review that factor, and it could be a big factor, or it could be a non-factor at all. It comes down to how you structure your benefit package to your employees. In other words, we don't have to put in a tier structure that is detrimental to retention and hiring. That's what we're going to talk about at this table, is the contribution levels. And clearly, the contribution levels can be adjusted. And it comes down to how you structure it. So the blanket statement that a defined contribution plan is at a disadvantage to defined benefit is just not true. It depends on the structure of both plans. And we're going to touch on a few of these things here. And working through this process, we need to come out with a tier that is comparable to tier three as much as possible. In other words, if you drop your benefit schedule along with your salary schedule to a point you're at a competitive disadvantage in the marketplace, you're going to hurt your organization. But the employer, I think, needs to have built-in flexibility. So in the event that that ever happens, they can respond. Does that?
Yeah, thank you. I'm sorry for the interruption. I'm glad we're heading in.
Senator Olson also has his hand up.
As we go back to this chart on page 3, where it says you need to stabilize the employer contribution rates, and how do we, number 2, I guess one of the questions that I have is, how are we going to go ahead and protect the employees? Because clearly it's not the fault of the employees of the poor investments that the investment boards made. And so I'd hate to go ahead and try and put just $5 billion gap on those people that are out there that were in good faith contributing so that these investment boards went ahead and made poor decisions.
Madam Chair, if I could respond to the Senator's question. In my opinion, and I'm not an attorney, but in my opinion, it is not the obligation of the employee to fund that $5 billion shortfall. It's an obligation of the employer. That's part of the risk inherent in having the employer having a defined benefit plan. That if they don't do adequate contributions, have adequate performance in their investments, it's their responsibility, the employer's responsibility, to meet the obligations. And I think that's a very important point, that the employee is not at risk of losing these benefits, both current employed and retired. And there's also, when we look at contribution, which we'll look at here, I don't know if we'll get to it today, but further down, the employee contribution, if there's any adjustments to that, it is not to go to the $5 billion underfunded liability from the past. Those are two separate issues. The benefits that are being accumulated today for today's service compared to the benefits that were accumulated last year and the year before that, or 10 years ago.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Go ahead, sir.
Okay. Slide 5 shows a basic comparison between the defined benefit plan and the defined contribution plan. And currently, like at the bottom, it shows TERS and PERS under the defined benefit. And in simple terms, you're fixing the benefit out in the future. The employer is guaranteeing that these benefits will be made. There's formulas and contractual obligations made between the employer and the employee. Some of these benefits will run for the life of the employee and spouse. And the benefit payments are not tied into the directly into the funding level of the plan. The plan is backed by the employer's general assets. Under this condition, the state. On a defined contribution plan, works much like a 401k, where we're a profit sharing plan, where you fix the amount of contribution every year that goes in, and then it will work very, very similar to SBS and deferred compensation, which the state already has. Those monies will be invested in predetermined investment portfolios put together by the committee. And, you know, depending on if a person's risk adverse or in other words, he doesn't want to take, or she doesn't want to take any risk at all, and they just want a fixed rate return. So, or if somebody wants to be in a stock and bond combination and have a potential of a higher retirement value, that'll be up to them. That's the basic difference between the defined benefit and the defined contribution. There's advantages and disadvantages. We're on page 6 now. There's an advantage and disadvantages to both plans, and what we tried to do is put down some of the advantages and disadvantages for each group or each plan. And, you know, for instance, the defined benefit plan, you get a pooling of longevity risk. That's an advantage to the employer. We can use actuarial tables, mortality tables, to figure out how long people are going to be in the plan. You know, there's guarantees as far as income streams, and this defined benefit plan favors longer service employees generally, and it definitely favors older employees. There's some challenges with it, with a defined benefit, as the employer bears all the investment risk. It makes no difference to the employee if the employer makes any money at all in their investments. None whatsoever.
What's that?
That's why we're here today.
The risk to the employers, they have to estimate their liabilities and they have to hopefully fund for them, and which we've talked about here, and the challenge of that. And one of the issues is they have raising health care cost trends that are uncontrollable at the state level. and there's just more unpredictable and controllable cost. In other words, the benefit structure that we see today may be something totally different as far as the cost goes in 20 years or 30 years. Very difficult to predict 20 or 30 years out. And these defined benefit plans live forever until the last man passes away or last woman. The defined contribution plan, some of the advantage to that is it's portable. When the employee leaves service, they can take their funds with them. They can self-direct it. And if they so choose, hopefully have a higher rate of return than the state would offer under their auspices of management. It contributes to equity among employees. Everybody's going to be getting the same contribution based on salary. It's predictable. It gives stable costs and cash flow predictability to the employer. They don't have to worry about all of a sudden a big liability popping up on them. The shifts, they can shift off investment risk. In other words, they can be more risk averse or less risk averse, and they can control the long-term administrative costs. There's some challenges in that you have to educate your employees on how to handle the monies. It's a responsibility of the employer, which leads you want to have some accurate retirement planning. And you also have to have workforce management, and that ties into how you can do your contribution levels. But anyway, that's the general comparison. If we look at the next slide.
But if you, Madam Chairman, if you list employer bears investment risks as a challenge for the defined contribution, you should also list it as the employee bears investment risk as a challenge under the defined contribution.
Correct. We have that title as shifting of risk, but we can change that. Yes. Page 7, let me just correct a quick typo in the third column over. It's current PERS Tier 3, not Tier 2 and 3. But that gives you a basic rundown in table format of the comparisons between the existing tier structures and the Senate Bill 141, the next two pages. But Madam Chair, I'm prepared now to kind of switch gears and walk through Senate Bill 141, depending on our time frame and what you'd like
to
do.
Look at this.
Which is this one here.
Okay. We'll go ahead and continue.
Okay. For those that are following along, there's a handout, Senate Bill 141 walkthrough. It's this is just kind of a bullet pointed. I'm just going to kind of walk down, and there's references in here too where we can go from on to the defined contribution plan, which is the heart of the new benefit tier. The employee would, and again, these are all open for discussion. Well, we needed a starting point. The employee contributes 8% of compensation, and that goes in pre-tax. The employer does 3.5% of employee contributions, and that's across the board, for a total individual account contribution of 11.5%. Now, there's a medical component we're going to get into a little bit more that the employer contributes to, but for the retirement mechanism, those are your two major pieces. We reference some section numbers of the bill in the page so people can refer to them. And the thought process here of doing this type of a layout is to initiate a good discussion at the board level when we come back through and we revisit these. Now, the employee can go ahead and contribute additional funds if they have the excess revenue to do so, or they see fit, or they want to save additionally for retirement. There is a vesting schedule. All members of the deferred comp plan immediately vest the employee contribution. So at no time is the employee contribution would come under a vesting schedule. And what that is when somebody terminates, it's a calculation of how much money the percentage of their value they get to take with them. The employer portion, the employee gets to claim after 2 years of service 25% of the money that was put in the plan, after 3 years of service 50%, and on up to 100. So after 5 years, if the employee separates from service, 100% of the contributions made not only by them but by the employer for them can be rolled over, which is the next item, if they so choose, or taken with them, liquidated, whatever they want to do. They can roll it over into their IRA or take it to their next employer that has a 401k or another plan. So it's an affordability issue, which benefits younger people. The employment trends nationally is for people to have multiple careers throughout their working lifetime. And there's been a continual evolvement nationally to make the retirement plans portable amongst themselves. So an individual can, if they work for the school system, or they work for a construction company, or they work for a service firm in San Diego or wherever, can move their monies with them as they work through their lifetime. There'll be a range on the investment side. There'll be a range of investments selected by the Retirement Management Board. They'll put that system together, much like like SBS. SBS now, you get your investment selection, you check your little box, and you can go into the Alaska Balance Fund, or you can go into a fixed rate or whatever. That's how that structure would be set up. The participants, direct that investment, and as mentioned earlier, then they bear the risk and the rewards. Upon termination, 60 days after termination, they can pull their funds out. There's a time frame put in there that leaves the employer ability to catch up on their paperwork. So after they separate from service, they can go ahead and roll their monies. There's also a hardship issue.
Senator Bundy has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Stedman, on retirement, anything from a monthly disbursement to complete disbursement of the entire accumulated retirement fund?
I think some of that stuff will be worked out as we go forward, but generally speaking, there'll be a list of options available where a person could take out a mandatory distribution at age 70 and a half, where you have to start pulling it out. Most people would take a plan like this and roll it into their IRA upon separation of service. Or the employer that if the employee leaves the funds there, would have options, a whole range of them. It's pretty standard boilerplate nowadays in the industry.
Okay. They'll have. Yeah, the question I've gotten from a constituent was, well, if someone either invests very poorly or does something foolish upon retirement and expends all their funds, what happens to them then? Do they fall onto the welfare system? And do you envision some kind of sideboards so that, one, they couldn't take such a high risk investment that they that there would be no return, or at retirement, that they couldn't disperse all the funds in oil stocks or something, to buy oil stocks that might leave them destitute without any retirement.
I think the investment selection that the state will give them will be controlled. And the Alaska Investment, or Alaska Retirement Board would have a standard selection that would be very tight. It wouldn't be allowed individual issues like going out and buying oil futures or something goofy like that. But on the other hand, if someone separates from service, rolls their money into their IRA, it's really not the employer's responsibility to ensure that the ex-employee doesn't do something that's imprudent.
Okay, thank you.
Although I would add that the employer will have, just like SBS, there'll be a lot of educational information sent out. Madam Chair, with that, we're going to go into the medical program elements, and I think there's another presenter that would dearly love to come forward and speak to that issue.
Welcome, Tracy.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Tracy Carpenter, staff to Senator Light Green. The medical program elements of this bill are perhaps kind of the hardest to get wrapped around. This is where the concept of retirement really comes in this defined contribution retirement plan. First, the contribution by employers is set in the bill at 3.75% of employee compensation. This number is an actuarial computed number by Mercer on the projected medical cost rate for members participating in this program, which is considerably lower than the current 9%, roughly 9%. Members of the defined benefits plan. That money will go into a group health insurance fund to pay the employer's share of medical premiums when that provision kicks in. Retirement under this plan means that a person has to have been an active employee for at least a year before they can apply for retirement, and they must be either 65 years of age with a minimum of 10 years of service or have 25 years of service for a peace officer or a firefighter or 30 years of service for all other members. What that means is that if you retire from the system, you then have access to major medical insurance and a health reimbursement arrangement plan that there's a new feature of this retirement plan, which we'll get to at the bottom of the page. Once a member meets the retirement provisions, they're eligible to enroll in the major medical insurance plan, and this plan will obviously cover the member and the member's spouse and the member's dependent children. And if the member dies, the surviving spouse is also eligible to enroll, and the dependent children of the surviving spouse are eligible for insurance coverage. Retirees who meet the required years of service but who are not Medicare age eligible, which presently is 65, will be required to pay for the monthly premiums for the medical insurance. Once the retiree reaches 65 or the Medicare age, and it is in the bill as Medicare age to allow for changes in the federal system. so we don't have to keep going back and adjusting. Anyway, then there's a schedule that the retiree, the monthly medical premiums are then subsidized by the state, and the retiree's portion of that is based on their years of service as set forth here on the page, which is 30% for 10 to 14 years, 25% for 15 to 19 years, 20% for 20 to 24 years, 15% for 25 to 29 years, and 10% for 30 years. There's only one premium to be determined for a retiree and the retiree's family, and it's been clarified that the division or the retirement system administrator has the ability to request that separate rates be developed for individuals, single people, single retirees versus retirees with a family. The health reimbursement arrangement is a new feature, and the idea here is to have a separate fund that the employer contributes a dollar amount, a specified dollar amount, for each employee. It's 1% of the average annual employer group, or up to a maximum of $500. And the reason for the employer group specification is to ensure equity. So basically, it's going to be, if your average employer group salary is $35,000 a year, then it's $350 for every employee. Goes into this fund and is recorded in a separate account for each employee. It's basically bookkeeping because the fund is an employer-owned fund. Employees do not contribute at all. And every year, the Retirement Management Board will determine a rate of interest to be credited to the accounts. And the plan is, you know, an employee comes in and they work 30 years, contributions and interest accumulate over the lifetime of that employee. And once they retire, they are eligible to be reimbursed for their qualified medical expenses from the health reimbursement arrangement, and that also includes monthly premiums. Kind of skipped ahead there. If an employee terminates without retiring, then the funds in the health reimbursement arrangement revert to the trust. Unless a person comes back to work within that five-year period, at which time their account balance when they left would be reinstated to their name so that they could go ahead and continue to accumulate through the rest of their working lifetime if they were to stay and retire. Any funds that get reverted to the trust and don't get re-recorded to an employee are envisioned as being able to be used by employers to prepay their future contributions under this plan. So they take their assets they've already contributed and they can go ahead and pay for their employees in the current year, kind of saves them some money. Members who retire directly from the system are eligible, plus their spouse and their dependent children. And if the retiree dies, then the spouse and the member's dependent children are still eligible for being reimbursed for medical expenses. And the dependent children of the member are also eligible if both the retiree and spouse die, up until the point where they no longer meet the definition of a dependent child. There are no limits on the annual amounts that can be withdrawn or applied for to be reimbursed, except for the account balance. And that's the only limit that at least is set in the bill. Once the account balance is exhausted, then the benefit would end. And that's the end of my presentation. Senator Stedman.
A question that you may want to answer later. You had mentioned earlier that if there were recruiting challenges for talented employees, there'd be some flexibility in here in your proposal. Would you point that out when you get to it?
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Right now, I'm going to go down through some of the board structure stuff, but that...
Mr. Chairman, before you do that, can I ask a question on the medical program? Your opinion, you said that one of the benefits or the good points of the state's plan was that ours was prepaid. How would you rate this program as compared to the one that we have presently that you so much admire?
Well, I think beauty's in the eye of the beholder. And I would expect all of the things being equal that an employee would prefer to have a defined benefit situation concerning health care. In other words, where the situation we have today where you work a specified number of years and you get health care for life with no risk sharing of any of the premium or cost increases into the future. I think from the employer's standpoint, though, that is not the preferred selection just due to the risk level associated with it and the difficulty the employer has in calculating what that liability is that they're going to face in 20 or 30 years out under the defined contribution plan. Their current proposal in front of us now, the employee would go ahead if they separated early and pick up their own health insurance premium until such time they were at 65, and then there's some offsetting on the premiums depending on years of service. So I guess it depends on, you know, what side of the table one wants to view it from. But clearly there's been a evolution the last several decades in the country to move away from defined benefit plans due to the inherent risk level in them for the employer. So there is no clean cut answer. It just depends on what side you want to view it from.
Madam Chair, if I may go into the next section of the presentation, which is changes to the existing retirement system, mm-hmm. Board consolidation. Some of this is going to be repeat.
Page, are you on?
Page 3 of the handout we were still working on. If I may just pause for a second, Senator.
Right.
Senator Bundy, did I answer your question?
No, I meant to just when will the flexibility or how would the flexibility come in if someone needs to sweeten the pot, if it were, for recruitment, and when it's appropriate to get to that?
One of the disadvantages from the employer standpoint, I think, of the system we have today is it's embedded in the Constitution and there's not a lot of flexibility if adverse conditions ever hit. Under the new tier proposal, there is flexibility. So not only in the discussion that'll come up as far as, you know, what rates should the employer contribute at, and clearly we'll probably have a range where some entities may want a substantially higher rate, some a lower rate, and we'll work through that political process to try to come up with a fair rate that may be a little different than what's proposed. Although I think what we proposed is fair, there might be some adjustments and certainly amenable to listening. In the future, whatever rate was set, if the state was found itself in a position where we had retention problems and or hiring problems, we'd have the ability to come back and
we want to increase those contribution rates, increase them. It's very, very difficult to take something away, and it's very easy to increase it. And as we'll see when we work through these, you know, these systems, but that's...
If I might just make sure I understand, the current systems that are prescribed in Constitution, of course, are then inflexible by definition. This new bill, which would not necessarily require a constitutional amendment, would maintain then some flexibility.
Correct.
Thank you.
That's my understanding, the intent. We go into page 3, under the board consolidation. As referenced yesterday, this bill would go ahead and consolidate the three current boards, which is the Public Employees Retirement System Board and the Teachers Retirement System Board and the Alaska State Pension Investment Board. Consolidate those down into one board, and we're calling it the Alaska Retirement Management Board. It would be comprised potentially of 9 individuals appointed by the governor, the Commissioner of Administration, Commissioner of Revenue, 3 Alaska residents who do not participate in the retirement system at all, the state, municipal, or the teacher retirement system. We'd have 1 financial officer from a political subdivision, basically a city or a municipality. We would have 1 financial officer from the school district, and we'd have 1 member from the PERS group, 1 member from the TERS group. The qualifications, we tried to move away from having qualifications of just political connection and reference a background in either investment management, finance, banking, economics, accounting, pension administration, actuarial analysis, something that can be tied in to the ability of the person to read and comprehend the actuarial and financial information presented to them. Because when there's a mistake made, it's most likely going to compound and become a big one, and we want to minimize it. We recommend that the terms be staggered for 3 years, and there's a term limit put in where they can serve for 3 consecutive terms and then have at least a 1-year break. Then we went down and we looked at the authority and the responsibility of the new board. And the some of the main ones is to manage the assets of the defined benefit trust and meet the pension liabilities. Because we don't want them out managing the assets, ignoring the liabilities. Because when the liabilities and the assets get mismatched like they are today, that's when we have problems. We'll have, you know, we recommend an annual actuarial valuations system and have that coordinated with the retirement plan administrator. And we want an analysis of the actuarial assumption experience of healthcare costs done annually. That might be a little heavy, but that's caused us some problems in the past, and we can come back and visit it later if that's too burdensome. And then other assumptions not less than every 4 years. So we want the system to be reviewed on an ongoing basis. We'd like to have an audit done of the actuary every 4 years. So if they start getting off track, we can be notified of that fairly soon so we can get it back on track. The rate setting, the employer contribution rates, including normal cost and past service cost, they'll deal with that again. The normal cost is the cost incurred today for the benefits accumulated for today's service. That past service cost issue is the $5 billion. And I think it's important that people clearly make a distinction. They're two separate items, and it's really easy to reverse them or mix them together. We're currently looking at the normal service cost, which is today's contribution, or today's cost for the benefit being accumulated today, being roughly split 50-50 between the employer and the employee. And that, again, is a starting point for the discussion. The main issue here is to get it on the table. So we look at it and say, is currently it's about 66% employer, 34 employee. So this would raise the employee contribution. Now, in the end result, we may not want to change what we have today, but we need to talk about it and make that decision. And we're going to have interest rates accredited to the individual employee account. The board will be responsible for overseeing all the individual accounts and the health reimbursement account. And then also going to be responsible for offering a range of investment selections for the employee-directed accounts. Other duties of the PERS-INTERS board, that's been changed. Because under this proposal, those two boards will no longer exist. To the Commissioner of Administration is the adoption of regulations governing the retirement system. And requests for a waiver of any adjustment made to the retirement system amounts due to a change in error or contributions or benefit computations. In other words, if an employee has a question on their account due to the calculation of contributions and or any other questions, they go ahead and run it through the Commissioner of Administration. They'll take care of that. There'll be an Office of Administrative Hearings run for appeals. So the appeals will run through the Office of Administration Hearings, much like other appeals within the state. So the administration and the Office of Administrative Appeals will deal with administrative issues and appeals. The board main obligation is going to be to deal with the assets and the liabilities on the current plan to try to get those into match or into balance, and then to deal with the structure and the ongoing new plan. Again, we'll have to come back through the public hearing process and see what the union representatives have to say about changing the contribution rates, where they're comfortable at, and what they'd like to see. But I think moving forward, we need to make a clear distinction between, again, that past service cost and the normal service cost. But with that, Madam Chair, that kind of about wraps up the comments I had for today. There is one other handout here that's on legal size. A comparison between the different systems in place, PERS and TERS, the new board, and it gives some comparisons going back and forth between them. And what we're trying to do is get enough information out to the public so we can facilitate a robust discussion of pros and cons, and we can work through this with amendments and come down with a new tier proposal that is fair and comprehensive, not only to the employees, but to the state and to the citizens of the state. With that, Madam Chair, I would.
Okay, Senator Hoffman, you have a question?
Yes, I do. On your past service cost, that's going to be calculated at a time of transition, $5.5 billion and such. Is that obligation going to have an interest rate to it, and what type of a term were you looking at the past service cost being spread out over?
Madam Chair, I think when we look at the past service cost, which is that $5 billion unfunded liability, that will not change with the creation of the new tier. The new tier would be put in place, and all new employees would go into the new tier. All existing employees would stay where they're at, except for a few of the newer ones will have the option of transferring if they want to into the new tier. But that past service cost stays with tiers one, two, and three, the current structure. Doesn't go anywhere. The new employees have no really effect on it, no responsibility for it. So it's not tied into, it's not divided up or spread out amongst any of the groups. It just basically stays right where it's at.
But this is the employer's right here. That's part of your employer's contribution rate. At some point, if you have your normal costs and your past service costs, mm-hmm. and say that you're going to have 50-50, at some point that past service cost is going to be, that $5 billion is going to be paid off. So I was wondering what term did you envision that being paid off, or is that the life of employees between now and retirement in 30 years?
Well, let me clarify that, Madam Chairman, because that's a very good point that Senator Hoffman brought up, and a point of confusion. The split, that 50-50 split that I was talking about, just goes to the normal service cost. Just the normal service cost. The past service cost, and it would have been nice maybe to have them in two separate sentences, but the past service cost is a separate entity, not related to any 50-50 split. The current employees, and retired people too, but more particularly the current employees, in my opinion, and again, I'm not a pension attorney, but my opinion, they have no obligation legally to go back and help the state pay that past service cost. That's a liability of the state. The reason that 50-50 split on the normal service cost was put in there is to recognize that there's been large changes in the cost of health care and benefits over the last couple of decades. And we thought it was prudent for the state to sit down when we're looking at all this stuff and just ask the question, you know, is the current split, which is basically 66% employer and 34% employee, is that fair today, or should we move it up to a target rate of 50-50 each, or some number in between? It's going to be a point of discussion. I don't know if there'd been adoption to change the current ratio or not. But the past service cost is the $5 billion underfunding, and that definitely is not in that.
And Madam Chair, I'm aware of that, but at some point we have to pay that $5 billion off. And is there a plan for the current people that are under the first three tiers that is going to be paid off, or is that the life of the retirement, and once those people retire, then it's magically paid off at that point? When does that $5 billion get paid completely?
Madam Chair, it may never. We may, let's just for a conversation assume we adopt the new tier, and now we've got this $5 billion liability that was created this year going back the last several. We may as a policy decide at this table that we're never going to pay that off. We're just going to let it run for the next 10, 15, 20 years, and then whatever's left, deal with it. Or we may, you know, do something that we may pay part of it down. That whole discussion, I think, should be put on the table for a later date, after the new board has the time to get together and come back, review the situation, and come back with recommendations.
So there isn't anything in here under this rate setting. You have employers' rate contribution rates. One of them is going to be normal cost, and then the board can decide what the past service costs are going to be on a percentage basis. But that's, to me, seems like somewhere along the line, if you pay it off early or pay it off late, it's not going to be, it's the state's obligation. and it's going to have to be paid off, as you said earlier in your presentation, I believe it was yesterday, that bill is going to come due someday.
Correct.
Madam Chair, the reason we didn't tackle that past service liability with this bill is the complexity of the issue. It was getting to the point just that we thought it would just make things too complex, and it's so easy for people to take that past service cost, that unfunded liability, the $5 billion, and assume that, you know, we're going to try to, you know, do something with the payment structure from the employees to help pay that off. So we wanted to make a clear distinction. And not only that, the issue of that you brought up earlier about, you know, is it getting, are we at the bottom? Is it getting a little worse, a little better? We have time to take a look at that past service cost, that $5 billion, and do an orderly analysis of it and set some policy to try to correct it.
But I guess then just a comment. The $5 billion is why we're here, and if we're not going to be addressing it and doing all of this monumental change without addressing the reason why we're here, it seems as though we're not fulfilling our obligation or fulfilling our commitment to resolving the problem.
Madam Chair, may I just respond to that? The reason why we decided to go down the track we did, and other folks in this building decided for whatever reason to address the $5 billion first, I think, for one thing, I don't think they have the ability to define the problem. The problem, the $5 billion problem didn't just show up because a perfect storm hit Juneau. I mean, there's systemic problems embedded in our system. And what I'm afraid of doing is throwing not tens or hundreds of millions, but billions into a problem, and we don't fix the problem. So the first thing to do, we concluded, was fix the problem, then come back and fix the result of the problem, which is the $5 billion. If you reverse it, I'm afraid we may be in a position where we put hundreds of millions, if not billions, into a problem that just reoccurs on us into the future. That was the thought process, and that was a discussed issue. Should we just go after the $5 billion problem, or should we first fix the issue at hand of why we got there? And that's another reason why it's a two-step process. So I'm hoping that, you know, this will be adopted, and we'll probably be sitting here in a year pounding the table on dealing with the $5 billion. It's a huge number. It's one-fifth of the Alaska Permanent Fund.
Tracy has something she wanted to interject to. Go ahead, Tracy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hoffman, nothing in this bill is changing the way that the employer rates are calculated. At the present time, the actuary calculates the unfunded liability, which is the past service rate, and what that is it amortizes over 25 years, that $5 billion number, at about a 4% interest rate, and that's how they come up with the past service rate. And the employer is required to pay that. And you can refer to page 11 on the PowerPoint presentation that was handed out that shows the actuarial computed rate for both systems. And if you go to the bottom, fiscal year FY 2006, you'll see that the rate's 25.63% for PERS and 38.85% for TERS. And I believe that is the big problem that we're facing, that employers are facing, having to pay rates like that every year for the benefits.
Is it not true that that rate, just if you were to run that calculation out, it generally continues to increase? That
yes, Madam Chair, it goes up higher for PERS up into about somewhere in the 30%, and for TERS, I believe it goes up into the 40, approaching 50% into the future, for the next 25 years.
And by not doing anything, we continue that problem to generation after generation after generation. And this at least stops the trend with the current set of systems we use. And like Senator Stedman said, something has to be changed in the system before we decide whether it needs great infusions of cash or whatever other solution someone comes up with. And did that answer your question, Senator Hoffman? You look very satisfied with this answer.
Much as possible.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Senator Stedman, I just kind of find it inconceivable that the idea of not paying for the liability would even be on the radar screen. How do you envision that happening, that we would have that option?
I don't think it's, Madam Chair, I don't think it's a viable option myself, but when we, hopefully someday we sit down with a laundry list of all the options we have to deal with it. One of them is just to pay it off. Uh-huh. Of course, we don't have $5 billion to pay it off. And the other option is just to ignore it and let the plan run. And I think both those options are not acceptable, and we have to come somewhere in the middle. But you could technically just ignore the underfunding and have the real high contribution rates on the employers and just run the system. But I think it's detrimental to the economy of the state of Alaska to do that. Again, it shifts too much cash flow today into employee benefits that were accumulated 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and misdirects it, as far as I'm concerned. The solution is going to be somewhere in the middle. Clearly, ignoring the problem is not the solution. And we don't have the ability to write a check and fund it. And if we did, I would still question that, because we need to fix the reason why we're here first. And then if we decide to pay down a portion of it, or there's pension bonds, there's other mechanisms, we can actually do a targeted rate of lower our target funding rate. And we have some flexibility.
Try to make sure that the employee doesn't come out on the short side.
Well.
Any other questions on the discussion today? Thank you very much. Another good discussion. This will continue next week, but for tomorrow, the capital requests will be presented by the Department of Health and Social Services, Labor, Law, Division of Military Veterans Affairs, and the University. And we'll begin tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Hope to see you all then. Thank you very much.